the Offside Rule exclusives.
146 caps for her country, a World Cup bronze medal and a host of club honours from FA Cups to league titles. Jill Scott has done it all. But England manager Phil Neville says she can keep going until she's 40, so she's definitely not done yet. Born in Sunderland, the Manchester City player had a choice between running and football, and fortunately for her club and country, she chose the latter. Speaking with the Offside Rule, Jill discusses getting over the 2019 World Cup disappointment, her love for her family, and what's on her mind after football.
The Offside Rule exclusives with Kate Borsay.
Well, we're at the City Football Academy for our next exclusive, and I'm sat opposite Jill Scott. Hi, Jill.
Hello, nice to see you.
Thanks for having us. It's quite sunny outside. It's just before Christmas, actually. And I wondered, well, look, you've had this mega media engagement recently. We switched on full well Christmas lights, yeah, which must have been the pinnacle of your sponsorship endorsements, or not. But just tell us a little bit about where you're from and what that means to you as well.
Yeah, well, Sunderland is my hometown, and Fulwell is a part of Sunderland. So, yeah, that's kind of like my little town. And, yeah, they asked us to go up and turn the Christmas tree lights on, which it was just a local Christmas tree, but it was just so nice to get up home and see everybody. I think there was about 100 people gathered round, and I think 75 of them were my family. So, but, yeah, it was a great day. And I think Sunderland always holds a special place in my heart. Whenever you go through the city, it's just football, football, football. And I think that's why I've probably gone on to achieve what I have, because of being born in Sunderland, yeah, and being raised there.
You don't have a choice in Sunderland, do you?
No, you don't.
About football?
No.
And the documentary about it is absolutely right, isn't it? The whole essence of it. Your life revolves around it.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. I think from a young age, you're given a football strip. Even as a baby, I think you've got pictures of you in football kits, and yeah, you have no choice at all. And then you're carted off to football matches probably before you can walk, I think. So yeah, you definitely don't have a choice. And people say there's something in the water because we have a bit of grit and determination, I think, the players that are from there. So yeah, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Is that, you think, relate back to your work ethic as well? Because when you say grit and determination, I think of you when you say that, and your work rate and your athleticism. We were talking before about you being probably one of England's most important players, you know, an engine within the team. Does that all stem, do you think, that kind of work rate all stem from your upbringing?
Yeah, I think I know that the work rate side is my main part of my game, and I'm not ashamed of that. I know there's parts of my game in terms of technical and stuff like that where players excel more than me in them areas, but yeah, it's definitely something that I'm proud of. I think one thing is, as I was kind of coming through the ranks, I suppose, or centre of excellence and stuff like that, I wasn't always the best player, and I think that's where I've probably got my determination from, because I was determined to work hard and become not one of the best players, but I always thought I need to be a player that somebody needs in their team, and that's something that I've had to work hard for. And I think that work ethic side is probably what does get us into England and into teams like Manchester City, but it definitely gets a bit harder now that I'm a bit older. But yeah, I love that part of the game. I still love, like, a Kevin Ball, who used to play for Sunderland, style tackle where the player goes flying up in the air on a slide tackle. I'm still very old school, to be honest.
And that was really astute of you, actually, to at a young age recognise, right, you know, I may not set out to be the most skillful player, but I'm going to be the most useful player. I'm going to make sure that I'm useful within a team.
Yeah, I think when you play for younger teams, and even as I got older, really, I think some managers will probably want to play them, the players who's got the skills and the technique and the flash players. And I think I remember thinking to myself one day, I won't tell the story because then I'd be bringing the manager out, but I remember thinking, you might not
come on, Jill.
No, I can't. But they'll be like, you might not want to players, but I'm going to make you need to players. And I remember saying that in my head. And I think ever since I said that to myself, it's going back a few years now, I think that's where it stemmed from, having this attitude where I was like, I'm going to make you need me. And I think I did kind of change their decision. I won't reveal if it's a male or female.
I think I can take it. Well, I can take a guess at either one of two people, but I'll let our listeners, yeah, surmise for themselves. What was your family life like? I've met met your brother. I don't know how many you've got, but I've met one of them over in Canada who was just full of pride.
Yeah, so I've got one brother and two sisters. So I've got an older sister, and that's where a lot of people have seen on my social media. My nephews and my niece, I'm very proud of. They're my older sisters. And then I've got a younger sister who, well, I say younger, she's 22, 23 now. So she's the baby of the family. So, yeah, I feel very lucky for my childhood. My mum and dad split up from a young age, but probably benefited from having two Christmases at times. And, yeah, had a very happy childhood. My mum was responsible for a lot of that and always put us first, always worked hard to enable that we could go on to achieve our dreams. And I think one thing I've always said about my mum is she never put us under any pressure. So I used to just take myself off to football age 9, 10. The coach at the time used to pick us up because back then that was allowed, and he was a great guy. I still keep in touch with him now, and I used to just come back in from football, and some days I don't even think she knew that I'd been, but I just liked how I could.
Poor kids, you probably lose one occasionally and you wouldn't notice, right?
She was probably like, that's one less tea to make tonight. But I also did running as well, and I spoke to her the other day, and it was interesting because she used to like to come along to the running events because it's in the sun, the running around the track, everything's nice. Or would you rather our daughter was on muddy pitches getting kicked by 30-year-old women?
A couple of men and a dog watching.
Yeah, exactly. But I was 14 playing against 30-odd-year-old women, and she hated watching. So I think she, at the time, would have rather I'd pursued the running. But yeah, she's very proud for what I've kind of gone on to achieve.
How did that happen then, being a teenager yet playing against fully grown women? How did that?
Because at the age of 14, I got into Sunderland first team along with Steph Horton, Carly Telford. That was the age that you could play with the first team from them. And yeah, it was tough. They were obviously a lot bigger than me, even though I'm tall now. But I think that's where we knew we had to be rough and ready to compete. So I think there's definitely something in that as well. But they also didn't hold any punches. I remember coming on for my debut at Sunderland. Again, I won't reveal the name, but centre midfielder turned around and was like, why are you putting her on at the top of our voice? And I was just this scared little kid. And I remember going on and thinking, Jill, don't make a mistake. So, but from an early age, I recognised, like, if you're not going to get it right, you will get told. And I think that's why now I'm quite open to criticism and can take it on the chin.
Mm. That's very interesting. And the running, I knew about the marathon running. In fact, it comes up in a lot of the Lionesses stuff. Because I get that it's something that you're very proud of, and rightly so. But did you also do kind of shorter distance as well?
Yeah, well, that mini marathon win in London is kind of, people think of it as a marathon. I was 13 at the time and it was about 3.5 miles, but yeah.
Take it, Joe.
But I ended up winning it. But yeah, I did a lot. I still remember my times now. Age 14, I was running 4:47 for a 1500 metre.
Wow.
So I was on English school standard times, and I think they really believed if I'd stuck at it, I could have gone on to run for England. But it was the enjoyment side, really. I used to win and I'd be like, oh great, I've won, and then that was it. But I think when you win with a team, it's just different. And my passion was always with football. Running was just something that came about because I'd done well at the football.
So you preferred that kind of tribalism aspect of football, I suppose, being in a team, working as a team, winning as a team, rather than perhaps the kind of solo glory of running.
I think if people that know us as a person, they know that I'd be no good at an individual sport. If I'm in the gym,
why not?
Because if I'm in the gym now and I'm told to do things on my own, I end up just mucking about, and I turn into this child, to be honest with you. I start singing and stuff like that. I'm just a team player. I know I'm a team player. So although I do think I've got the dedication, I don't think I would to be an individual athlete. I think you have to be very comfortable with time on your own, and I'm probably not.
Well, that's probably the result of being one of four kids.
Yeah.
And it's that attention span thing as well. I think if you're a solo player, you have to really be able to concentrate for long periods of time. And that doesn't suit everyone, does it?
No, it's actually funny. This is going to sound quite embarrassing, but when I was playing in a major tournament, I used to actually I used to speak to someone because I'd be like, how do I keep concentrating for the whole 90 minutes? And they were like, what do you mean? And I was like, and I used to have to think about out the game in 15-minute spells.
Blocks,
which,
to be able to get through it.
Yeah, I know that sounds quite, like, embarrassing saying it now, but an hour and a half is a long time sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm always busy, obviously got things to do on the pitch, but, yeah, sometimes I'd feel like time was going so slow. So I used to meet with kind of a psychologist, and they used to take us through techniques of getting through games. So that's probably an interesting fact.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I know that you've spoken about working with psychologists before and the kind of the mind. What did you call it around England? The mind something or other.
The mind gym, was it?
The mind gym.
You're testing us now if I listen.
Well, I know. I'm asking you to dredge up the research that I should have written on this piece of paper. The mind gym.
Yeah, because I think people obviously neglect it sometimes. You do your technical, tactical work on the pitch. You do your strength training in the gym, but... God, 80% of it or even more is in your head, I think. Like, when you're out there and things aren't going well, I know you rely on probably your speed and your skills, but it's what's in your head. Are you willing to put the work in? But we had a guy called Adam Streeter when we were with Mark Sampson, and he was fantastic. He really was. He would make us do things like that were really uncomfortable. I remember one particular day turning up, and it was set out like a speed dating type thing. Not that I've ever been speed dating. And you had a minute, was it about 30 seconds with each player, and you just had to tell them why you thought they were so good. And even though that sounds so easy to say, it was quite uncomfortable to do, but it just made us appreciate each other a lot more.
Yeah, that's interesting. And what about school and stuff? Were you always just really, really sporty, or did kind of academic or kind of schoolwork come into it at all?
I'm not going to blow my own trumpet, but I do think I was naturally quite clever. My brother and my sister, my brother's a physics and chemistry teacher in Spain and deputy head of a school over there.
Wow.
My younger sister's just got a master's in criminology. So I was in an underachievers group at school because they thought that I wasn't putting in enough work to achieve my grades. But I think I was probably putting in too much work on the football pitch and was just knackered for school. But I think, yeah, probably concentration again. Whenever I was at sit in my room and do revision, I'd end up performing a concert, like pretending I was like at Wembley performing some kind of I just didn't have the attention to do it. But again, I always say to my mum, like, thanks for just letting us kind of do what I need. I'm not saying that she didn't push us, but I remember when I had to pick my options and I said to her, I really want to do art. And she was like, why? And I said, I like the people in the class. I was rubbish at art, but she let us do it. And I think that's one thing I am grateful for, that she didn't say I had to do this and I had to do that.
What kind of, or who were you pretending to be in these concerts in your bedroom whilst you're supposed to be doing it?
Spice Girls, yeah.
Which one?
Oh, probably Sporty, it'd have to be, wouldn't
probably.
It? yeah, I'm making myself sound a bit crazy, aren't I? But yeah.
No, but I think we know that about you anyway. You've got a really strong personality. We wouldn't be the first people to speak to you where you've revealed a few wacky things about yourself. So you can let rip, it's fine.
The Offside Rule exclusives.
Most capped England player at the World Cup. So you're getting to that point in your career, aren't you, where people are calling you a veteran?
Yeah.
How does that feel?
Yeah, I think there's been probably this year a few records kind of that I've broken. As you say, most caps at a World Cup, which I actually can't believe that. To break that is fantastic. And then also most WSL appearances as well at the weekend. So, yeah, I think when them records start coming around, you start to think, have I done well or am I just getting old and I've been around too long? But yeah, it is. It's hard to take sometimes because I just feel like that young kid running around the football pitch. Yeah, everything hurts a little bit more, but I still feel like I can physically compete. But I just feel like this number's getting higher and higher. I'm 33 next year, so I know that I'm not going to play forever, but in my head, I still think I can.
Which is a good mentality to have. And I know Phil said that you can carry on playing until you're 40. So apparently you're fine for another two or three tournaments, Jill. And what's it like thinking about, because I guess when you start to kind of break those records and when you start to kind of get called a veteran and a role model, you do start to think about what's kind of coming up next as well. Do you have to think about that now, the next stage, or actually is it better for you to just not think about that yet?
I think since joining Manchester City, I probably have thought about it more because I think they are eager to make sure that you've got a plan, which is great. But then at the same time, I am very much just think to the next day kind of person. So
I probably can't concentrate on three.
Yeah, probably can't. That's true. Day-to-day tasks are a struggle. But yeah, I think in my head, I know that time's going to come, and it doesn't scare us. It really doesn't. I think I'm quite excited for it. And I think with my personality and stuff like that, will I go into one thing? Probably not. I'd like to do a bit of coaching. I've done like a few talks recently at different events and stuff.
And you've got your coaching school, your coaching academy as well, haven't you?
Yeah, coaching academy as well. So yeah, I think I'll just have to, I kind of see it as starting out again, really. Like even with coaching, they say, oh, you could go on and be manager of this team, manager of that team. But I think it'll literally be like when I started playing football again, I'm going to have to be told that I'm bad at things, I'm going to have to work at things, and I'm going to have to put in the hard work to kind of reach the levels that people like Nick Cushion, Casey Stoney, there's so much work goes on behind the scenes that people don't see. And that worries us a little bit, if I'm being honest.
That's fair enough. I look at people like Casey and I have wondered whether you've looked at someone like Casey and thought, actually, that would be a really good thing for me, or whether there are players around you, whether at City or at England, and you think, they're going to be the next Casey Stoney, the next player to really go and make a serious go at sort of managing. And also in Casey's case, obviously she's enjoying a lot of success at the moment.
Yeah, I think Casey's one of my good friends and someone that has always offered me advice throughout my career, and someone that I really respect. We've had some great conversations over the years, and I think she was always going to go on to manage or coach. But then I look around and I think the knowledge that Farrah Williams has on the game, obviously she's still playing now, but I hope that she goes into coaching or management. But you just never know, do you? It's where people's passion lies, and opportunities as well. It's not like you just finish playing and then all these people knock on your door and say, do you want a job? You have to go out there and find opportunities. And then I suppose opportunity without hard work is nothing. So I am a big believer in kind of just do the right things day by day and the rest will take care of itself. But I could be sitting in here in a few years with no job. So
oh, Jill.
Don't hold us to that.
I've just turned over the page of my notes, and the first page, Jill, looks like I'm quite a good student. The second page just looks like I have a very disorganised brain indeed. And I'll try not to hold this too close to Jill, because it's probably tempting, is it, when someone interviews you to just look over and see what's that next question she's going to ask me.
I can't even help you with this one.
Your role in the England setup and at City as well, actually, are you sort of taking and are you happy with a senior role? Do you help the younger players? How do you use your experience, I guess?
Yeah, obviously I recognise that I'm a senior player and there's younger players coming through. I've never actually been given an official senior role.
Shocking.
I need to question them on that. Maybe it's because I like to have too much of a laugh or they don't take it too serious. But I think a lot of my kind of leading by example comes on the pitch. I'll always give the girls advice if they need it, but I think from the way that I play, I think that's where I always demand high standards in training and games and stuff like that. But I think the girls always know that I'll always be there for them if need be. I think in terms of the leadership official roles, there's a lot of meetings and they'll probably think that I turn up late, so I think that's why they always bypass my name.
And do you think the younger players coming through now are different to you guys when you were that age, because they have been subjected, I suppose, to a certain point, to better facilities? It's now a professional game, and I know that we're not probably seeing the full knock-on of that yet, but do you look at some of the players coming in and are they different to how you were in any way at that age?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a time at Manchester City where there was a bit of a transition of younger players coming through and getting contracts at, say, 17, 18. And there was probably a bit of frustration from their behalf on how we were and probably ours on how they were. And it took us a bit of time just to reflect on each other's journeys and be like, look, we've had such different journeys. We kind of need to meet halfway, because you never want to be that person that says, my way is the right way and we never used to get any of this back in the day and you should be so grateful. And at the end of the day, your journey is your journey. journey, and what you don't know, you'll never know. So we have a very good group here now, and I can probably use me and Kira Walsh as an example. It's probably 10 years between us, but I recognise what a fantastic player she is, and obviously she's came in here, and yeah, she's been given the facilities and stuff like that, but she's worked so hard at our game to now be a starter at Manchester City and England, and rightfully so. And I think she, the other way around, respects kind of my hard work and what I bring to the team. So it's a bit of a good story in the fact that we've had such different journeys with such different players, such different people, but when we step out onto that pitch, it somehow works.
This is the Offside Rule from Muddy Knees Media.
You've been to 8 major tournaments, I think.
Yeah.
A lot. Yeah. With the England side. What's been the most challenging time, do you think, of your England career so far?
Oh, that's a good question. The tournament, the Euros in 2000 and, I have to get my years right now, 2013. I think that was challenging. I think because obviously Hope Powell was the manager at the time. She took the team to a fantastic place. We'd had such good success under her. And then I feel like we felt a lot of responsibility for letting her down in that tournament. We didn't get out the group. And on the back of that, she ended up losing her job. So I'd say that was a challenging time. Yeah, I know there's going to be call for change at different parts in the playing for England. But yeah, I think as players, we probably took that quite hard because we were the ones that were going out there and performing and we weren't performing.
That was over in Sweden, was it?
Yeah. But I think also when I look back on that tournament, there was just such fine lines, like we'd hit the post and if that had gone in, then we would have qualified from the group. And sometimes something so little can become such a big catastrophe. And I feel like that's what happened.
Mm. What did you think when Mark Sampson came in? Because he was so different, wasn't he? We've spoken to a few Lionesses over our time and it felt to them, and I'm not sure if it's the same to you, like it was just so different. There was such a different approach.
Oh yeah, it was completely different. The way that we played, I think obviously people could see we really relied on that determination and getting tackles in, winning the ball back and then just hitting teams on the counter. Whereas with Hope, we'd probably played a bit more possession football. And then we've gone back to possession football now. So yeah, it was different. But I think what happened was we started to get results, and then with results becomes belief. And then I think I'll always be obviously grateful to Mark and the staff for getting us that bronze medal at the World Cup, because I look at that every day and it's up on my wall, and that really does mean the world to me. So I think we had incredible players. If you look at the experience in that squad, Laura Bassett, Farrah Williams, Casey Stoney, yeah, and I think obviously to have that medal, Alex Scott, then it really represents a group of women that went on to achieve something big.
Yeah, and I think people, of course, they got excited about the World Cup over the summer, but I think that some newer fans to the game maybe don't appreciate, or some people don't remember, that Canada 2015 was really the Olympics, and then followed by Canada was, you know, really the start of that mega trajectory where, you know, people did get to know your name. I'm sure you got recognised more as well. I'm going to fast forward to the World Cup this summer. Does it feel too soon to sort of try and make an honest analysis of the tournament?
I think when I look back at it, obviously success would have been us getting to the final. I think that would have been incredible to have that game for the English fans. But I think our minimum requirement would have been semi-final. So it's a bit of a mad one. I don't want to sit on the fence, but I don't see it as an unsuccessful tournament. But then I don't see it as a successful one at the same time. But in terms of what we did for the game, we stayed in the tournament. We had 7 games, which is great to get on telly and get people interested. Obviously, we didn't get that bronze medal, but we competed in them games. And I think one thing from this tournament is that we had a lot of younger players. And I think the experience they'll have taken from this will have been incredible, because I know a lot of them hadn't played in major tournaments like that. So, yeah, I look back on that tournament with pride. I think we played well at times. Just fell short in that semi-final, really, against America. But we know now what we need to do to make sure that we're making finals.
Do you think it was the right thing to do to sort of set out from the start and say, we're going to win this? Because that was quite a bold statement, really, wasn't it? Do you think that helped or hindered?
No, I think it helped our mindset because we wanted to be there for the whole duration. And the thing is, I don't think it was any surprise to us that Phil said that, because from day one of him coming to La Manga, when Mo Marley actually took us, because it was when the appointment was being decided, and Phil Neville came and visited us for the last day because he found out that he had the job. And the first thing he said to us was, "We're going to the She Believes tournament. We want to win. We're going to win this. It was all about winning." So it didn't surprise us that that was his mentality, because he is a winner. He is a winner. If we don't win, I think he's just as moody as we are. But that's what you want. You don't want somebody that's going to be happy with us losing.
Do you think it's partly what made it quite difficult afterwards? I know you finished the tournament and you came back and you went pretty much nearly straight away into another couple of internationals.
Yeah.
Before then going to your clubs and sort of really starting the WSL season. Do you think that was hard? Because a couple of players have spoken, like Steph and Ellen have spoken about how actually it took them a little bit longer to get over not winning it than they had anticipated.
Yeah, I openly said that I struggled. I think it was 10 days later when we were back in here, and suddenly your club manager and a lot of the club players had 8 to 9 weeks off because they hadn't made the World Cup with their nationalities. But I remember sitting in that first meeting and I was so fatigued mentally, physically. Like, 7 games at that level is a lot. And I remember sitting there and they were like, "Right, we're going to try and win the league, win the FA Cup, win the Continental Cup. We've got Champions League." And I just felt like I was just in this blur. And I remember, which I'm not ashamed about saying, but we went straight into fitness testing. And that day I just broke down. I was like, I'm just not ready to kind of be back and training at 100%. But I spoke up and Manchester City was so good with me and give us I didn't have time off, but just my training was kind of tapered down a little bit. But you don't realise how much it actually takes out of you. You're away from your family for 52 days, I think it was. You're putting everything into it. You've trained with this dream in your head and then it's just gone. And then it's like 10 days later, right, come on, off you go again. And I suppose you're only human at the end of the day. So, I'm not ashamed to admit that it was a struggle to just get back into the routine.
Phil believes in you a lot. He said some wonderful things about you as well. Playing until you're 40, you've got another two or three major tournaments in you. He's spoken about your work rate. You scored the fastest goal by a lioness, didn't you, against Norway? Yeah. So that's a nice one to add into the bank. What happens then when he says stuff like, "Players can thank their lucky stars that I'm in charge. You don't see many football managers taking the risks I do." So he's quite bold, isn't he, with some of the things he says. And I think some of the media think that he perhaps talks a bit too much. How do you work your head around that as players? Do you ignore it? Do you roll your eyes? How do you deal with those actually really quite bold statements?
I think when you're in a team and you're getting managed, I think the most important thing is just to listen to what's said but inside them four walls. I think things from the media can sometimes be exaggerated, or you don't know. I've done interviews before and the context that it's taken in is not the message I was trying to get across. So I think sometimes we have to let Phil say what he needs to say in the media for whatever reason. I know managers in the past have sometimes tried to play games and stuff like that. So for me, I never listen too much to that. I just think it's about what's said to you on a one-to-one basis, what you need to work on, and just really trying to stay logical. After a game, the emotions can be running high and things can be said. But if we're not performing, then we have to then be open to that criticism and them words that are going to be spoke about the team. But I do think we've got a good group of girls that, as I said before, will probably do take things on the chin and just get on with things, because that's all you can do, really.
Let's go back to your... I'm going to ask you about 77,000 fans at Wembley.
Yeah, it was incredible. It really was. It was kind of... That day was a bit of a whirlwind as well, just seeing all the... It was kind of the day before we went and had a coffee and there was all of our pictures up on Wembley Way, and yeah, it was actually crazy. I think we're probably... The first 20 minutes of that game, we didn't not play it at the occasion. I think we were nervous, and because it's just something that a lot of us... I think there was probably only three or four of us had actually experienced that at Wembley for Team GB, But yeah, it was such a good day, and seeing all the old players as well. That was a great day, especially for me being around for a while, so I knew a lot of
you
them.
You recognised everyone.
Yeah, all of them. I was like, hey. I was thinking maybe I should be walking around the pitch with you rather than playing. But yeah, it was a fantastic day for women's football, and I hope it's something that we can do again in the future.
Olympics coming up and a home Euros as well, so you better not go anywhere just yet. Yeah. What does that feel like, thinking about those tournaments coming up?
Yeah, I think the Olympics is one that really excites us because it's around the corner, and Team GB 2012 playing in London, that's one of the proudest moments of my career. It was probably the most enjoyable tournament, to be honest, just because, especially being an athletics fan, just walking around that village and Tom Daley would be coming out the same restaurant as you, or walking past Usain Bolt or Mo Farah saying morning, and I was like, am I in some kind of computer game? It was a weird feeling, but so incredible. And I've got the Olympic rings tattooed on my side because I probably just took it all in and loved it. So to get the opportunity to play in another Olympics would be a great feeling, but at the same time, there's only going to be probably 18 players go, and I know competition for places is going to be absolutely massive. If you look at the likes of Kim Little, Jennifer Beattie, Kaz Weir, Justin Erin Cuthbert, to name a few who can obviously make the Team GB squad as well, Jess Fishlock. So it's going to be so difficult to make that team, but I always say, as long as you try and do everything you can, and if you go, you go, and if you don't, as long as you can say you did everything, then I suppose that's one thing you can hang your hat on.
And the prospect of a home Euros, obviously, yeah. You've got such limited squad numbers, I suppose, for the Olympics, and you're right, it is across the different nations, home nations as well. But the prospect of a home Euros is, it's one of those points in time, isn't it, where you think, okay, we can build to another surge in the game here.
Yeah.
What's the do you ever feel the responsibility of that? Because you are one of the generation who's come from not a lot of high profile with the game to, through all these tournaments, 2012, 2015, World Cup 2019, then we'll have the Olympics, then we'll have a home Euros.
Yeah.
Do you ever sit back and feel any responsibility or feel any pressure?
Yeah, you do. I think even as an older player, when you touched on Wembley, everyone's like, do you not get nervous anymore? But I think you get more nervous because you do feel more responsibility. You're not that 19, 20-year-old kid just coming on for 10 minutes, maybe trying to make an impact or be a hero. Like now, well, in some games you're starting and there is a big responsibility on your shoulders. But I do say that we do feel that even in the World Cup. We know if we win that quarterfinal, there's another game on television. Which means that a young child might be watching it with the mum, the dad, and they might ask for a pair of football boots at Christmas. And I do think that we do feel that, and we do take that on quite well. I think a lot of the girls deserve a lot of credit because I do think they are fantastic role models, and they're always willing to go above and beyond to do things to promote the game and without any fuss as well, because we just want to keep making it better, and we feel privileged to be in this position to do that. I know if you told me 20 years ago I'd be sitting here and being able to kind of promote the game in the way that we can as individuals, then I would have said kind of aim to inspire before you expire. So that's something that I always try and do.
What could jeopardise the upward trajectory that women's football is on in this country, both club-wise and national as well?
I think results is massive. I think we've experienced it a little bit after the World Cup. As soon as we haven't got a couple of results, and this is in games that ultimately they don't really mean anything. They're not qualifying games and not tournament games, but that pressure's on us now because we're saying we want to take the game to the next level, but our performances and our results have to mirror that. So I think that's one thing. We've had a little bit of a hangover period after the World Cup, and we don't want to use it as an excuse. But I think in the past, when you come back from a tournament, you often have qualifying games against, no disrespect to these nations, but teams maybe like Serbia, Montenegro, stuff like that, where they are going to be a bit easier games. So you kind of ride through this period and still get the results. But I think we've obviously gone into the game of Brazil, against Brazil at Middlesbrough, again, 30-odd thousand there. The game at Wembley against Germany, the second best team in the world. So we've had to pick up big performances in order to compete with these teams, and we haven't been able to reach that level since the World Cup, which it doesn't worry me, but it seems to have worried a lot of the media, and there's been a lot of stories around the team. But I think that's something that we need to control, and we need to make sure that we keep winning the games to kind of keep everybody on this journey with us.
It's difficult, isn't it, because you're trying to keep the profile of the game after the World Cup, but at the same time, you're right, you know, you guys almost needed to play not huge nations, not have a huge spotlight again, because you're being asked to go again, aren't you?
Yeah.
Going through the World Cup, all the emotional rollercoaster, the physical demands of that, back into club, and then you're having to go again and again. And
yeah,
I suppose that's the tough thing about trying to make a legacy, is that you're almost working twice as hard, aren't you?
Yeah, you have to. We have to keep going. 2015, I remember we got back on the Wednesday.
That was
we didn't
crazy,
get back into
it?
Clubs till the Friday, and we were playing on that Sunday because we took responsibility that we'll, right, this is the time we can hit the crowds at the game. And I remember I was playing against Jade Moore that game for Birmingham, and obviously I'd experienced the whole of 2015 tournament with her playing alongside her, and I never do this in a game because I'm very like against it, but I remember saying, oh, just keep going, Jade, just keep going, because I think we were both in a mental place that was like, we need to just get through it. But I know I read an article from an American player, I don't think she played for the national team, but she really credited the England team for what we did when we got back from that tournament, because she said it's so difficult to keep going, but they take the responsibility of their sport very serious. So yeah, it is tiring, and we don't really get these long 4 or 5 weeks off, but at the end of the day we know that we have the best jobs in the world, and I don't really want to call it sacrifice, because obviously look at what we call work, and some days we're finished by 3 o'clock, and I know how hard a lot of people have to work out. I want to say the real world, but you know what I mean. So yeah, it's a privilege to be in this position, and something that we need to just keep pushing.
There's been a lot of talk about a wage cap recently. Sam Kerr has been signed by Chelsea. She'll start playing for them in January. There was also a story around the World Cup about Millie Bright and Ellen White, and if you'd have won it, they would have got this sponsorship deal that would have made them overnight millionaires.
Yeah.
Is there a danger then, with Sam Kerr on reportedly £300,000 a season, is there a danger that the financial side of it is going to get in the way, that there's going to be megastars like Sam Kerr turn up, and the game's having to deal with the megastars, but also paying respect to senior players like you who've been here from the very start?
Yeah. I think that's like anything sometimes in jobs. I think people can look at the pay and say, oh, well, do they get more money than them, and why are they? I think for me, obviously, I don't want to sit here and say money isn't important, because obviously money's important for a lot of reason in terms of family and stuff like that. But I've never been motivated by money, because I suppose on my journey, we were probably paying to play for a lot of the years, paying petrol and stuff like that. And
especially at Sunderland, you were paying to play,
exactly,
weren't you?
Exactly. And I look now and I'm very grateful for now to be playing full time and to be getting paid to do that. So I think you can always look left and you can look right and say, oh, well, look, she's got that sponsorship deal and she's done this appearance and it's reported this amount of money. But I think you can just waste so much energy. I'm actually, when that came out about Ellen and Millie, I was so happy for them, and every game I was thinking to myself, come on, let's push on, if we can make two of our players millionaires maybe they'll get the coffees in next time. But yeah, it's one of them. I know the money issue has come up a few times, but if Sam Kerr decides to come and play in our league and Chelsea are willing to pay that money, then yeah, I suppose that's their situation.
I'll fire some quick ones at you now, because I know we've got to wrap up soon. Away from football, 3 loves of your life.
Oh, God, that's a hard one. I can't say people because the others will get jealous. So 3 loves of my... So it's got to be coffee. Everyone says about coffee, but it is more the social element of coffee. My bed, because I like to have a nap. I do love to have a nap. And I'd have to say a football, just because obviously I'm training every single day.
It was away from football, Jill, but you can have that.
Oh, sorry. I'm tired. It's a concentration.
Are you an artisan coffee person? Are you a brand coffee person? Are you a Starbucks or a Costa person?
No, it's got to be independent coffee now. Costa was high on my list, but yeah, it's got to be independent coffee now.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. Two things that get you down. You're very upbeat, but what two things are really going to annoy you?
I hate when people's moods affect a group. I hate that sometimes. I'm like, just when you have like someone who's a bit of an energy zapper. I think maybe because I try and be upbeat. So I would say that. And also when you're driving and you give way and they don't put the hand up and say thank you.
Oh my God, that annoys me too. I'd have that so one rude. As well. I almost feel like driving my car out at them and saying, no, no, I won't let you through now.
Yeah, exactly.
You haven't given me a little flash of your lights and a wave. This is an odd one. This is from producer Rabbi. I'm going to blame her for this.
Okay.
If you were a dog, what breed would you be?
Oh, I'd have to be one of them skinny greyhounds, I think, probably. I reckon. I'd like to say a cute Labrador, but no, it'd be a skinny greyhound.
Ultimate Christmas present, nothing football related.
You know what? People keep asking us what I want this year, and there's nothing that... And this is going to sound so cheesy, but I said to my mum, I was like, I just want us to go to the markets and just to enjoy time. I think as you get older, I think it's about spending time as opposed to money. So I'm going to go up home and take my nephews and niece to a hotel and have a... just a couple of days of doing daft Christmas games and stuff like that.
Song that means the most to you?
Well, I've got a tattoo with it actually. So Step by Step, Day by Day, Mile by Mile, Whitney Houston. I think that probably sums me up in about 9 words or something.
Very good indeed. Your karaoke song of choice? Same one or something different?
No, it's...
actually, I think you'd be very brave to attempt Whitney Houston.
No, God, yeah.
Leave it alone.
Know your limit. That would be the equivalent of me taking Lauren Hemp in a sprinting race. I think sometimes you have to know what you're good at. I actually like that. Is it Light My Fire by Will Young? Just because
okay,
I like going,
nice.
Light My Fire. There you go.
If you could play abroad, where would you play?
Oh, somewhere hot. I think I'd like to go to Australia, actually. Yeah. Actually, they're connected to Manchester City, Melbourne. So come and get us in a few years.
Jill Scott, thank you very much. I know you haven't thought much about the future stuff, but surely media's got to be, especially if the managerial thing...
Yeah, I think
isn't
this stuff
out.
Would be all right because it's like face for radio, isn't it?
Oh, don't be silly.
I'm only joking. But yeah, I'd be open to do anything, to be honest. But
we'd like a Jill Scott chat show, I think.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think okay. So. As long as you can concentrate for long enough.
Yeah, no, it'd have to be like a 15-minute episode or something.
A YouTube series.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for joining us on The Offside Rule. Best of luck to you and Manchester City for the rest of the season and whatever's ahead for the Lionesses as well.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Offside Rule exclusives. To hear more like this, just go to available episodes where you'll hear from the likes of former England and Arsenal striker Kelly Smith, former England and Chelsea forward Ennio Luco, and Manchester United manager Casey Stoney, plus many, many more. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Offside Rule Pod and subscribe so you can be the first to hear our new episodes.
The Offside Rule is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.